There was a Peanuts comic strip where Charlie Brown and Lucy were having a philosophical discussion. Lucy said to Charlie Brown, "Life is like a deck chair, Charlie Brown. Some place it so they can see where they are going. Some place it so they can see where they have been. And some place it so they can see where they are at present." Charlie Brown thought about it for a minute, and his reply, "I can't even get mine unfolded." In the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon is having a bit of difficulty getting his deck chair unfolded. He's having a tough time sorting through life. Solomon has discovered that life can be a perplexing dilemma. It was Winston Churchill who said of the country of Russia, he called it a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. At times, life can be a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. When life doesn't go the way we expected it to, when life doesn't work the way we thought it should or thought it did, sometimes life can throw us a curveball. It can knock us off stride. We can have a difficult time sorting out life and the meaning of life and the purpose of life. It was Harvard professor and philosopher George Santayana who made this observation. Life is not a spectacle or a feast. It is a predicament. This is what Solomon discovers as he seeks to determine the meaning and the purpose for his life. He seeks to find ultimate satisfaction and fulfillment, and yet he runs into some roadblocks. Granted, life can be rough. Life can be disappointing. It can be disillusioning. Life seems to come at us full bore and doesn't wait for us to sort things out. It's been said that life can be understood backward, but it must be lived forward. And there are times when we're caught in the midst of life and life's dilemmas and life's struggles, and we're trying to put the pieces together, and yet we have a hard time finding what really matters in life. We approach life as if it were the proverbial rainbow, and we're searching for our pot of gold at the end. We expect to find it. Someone has suggested that the author's intent in Ecclesiastes is to show that at the end of the rainbow lies not a pot of gold, but a pot of salty liver soup. If you've ever faced life head on and left an experience with a bitter taste in your mouth, you're going to be able to relate to the message of Ecclesiastes. All too often, our concepts of fairness and fulfillment seem to be a fleeting fantasy. Chuck Colson says, "Life isn't a book. Life isn't logical or sensible or orderly. Life is a mess most of the time, and theology must be lived in the midst of that mess." Tonight we're going to find Solomon struggling to find meaning in the midst of that mess, dealing with the contradictions, dealing with the disappointments of life, and drawing his conclusions. The book begins, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." Now, this word preacher in the Hebrew is a very interesting word. It's a unique word. It's found nowhere else. The root of the word is the Hebrew word kahal, which means to assemble or to gather. What the writer here does is he takes the root word and he adds an ending to it and he makes it kohaleth, which means the leader of an assembly or a gathering, the leader of the congregation. The Greek translation of the Hebrew word kahal is the word ekklesia, or as in translated in our English Bibles, church. Church is a congregation, it's a gathering, a called out group. Thus, the title Ecclesiastes, or the leader of the church, or the assembly, or the gathering, or the preacher. And so we have here the words of the preacher, and he's identified as the son of David and as the king in Jerusalem. And to my knowledge, there's only one individual that meets both those qualifications. There was only one son of David who ended up king, and that was his son Solomon. Now, when Solomon wrote this book, we're really not sure. But there is a very interesting, a very plausible theory that I'd like to throw out. It's my personal belief. We know that Solomon wrote three books in our sacred writings. First, of course, is the book of Proverbs that we've just finished studying. Here, the book of Ecclesiastes, and then the book we'll come to next, the Song of Solomon. The theory goes that Solomon wrote his song when he was young. After he had fallen in love, he wrote it to his maiden, the one that he loved and had such fond affections for. The book of Proverbs was written during his middle years, when he was at the peak of his wisdom and of his mental powers, when he was at the pinnacle of his success and position. But the book of Ecclesiastes, or so it goes, was written just before Solomon's death, when he was old, after he had spent some time backslidden from God. We do know that toward the close of Solomon's life, he fell away from God. He began to follow the idols and the false gods of the neighboring nations. He brought idolatry into Israel. And Solomon was a blight upon the record of the nation Israel. But the theory goes that later in his life, Solomon came around. And the book of Ecclesiastes is his confession. It's the record of the futility that he found apart from God. It's his expression of new commitment to God, and to serve and to follow God, and to make priorities out of the things that matter most in life. I believe that this book was written as a confession. It was a record of his years apart from God, and the frustration, and the emptiness, and the unfulfillment that he found. And it's his desire to share his wisdom and his experience with us, that we might not make the same mistakes. He begins, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Here's the theme of the book in a nugget, in a nutshell. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Now, there's a key word in the book of Ecclesiastes, and there's a key phrase. The key word we find here, it's the word vanity. It appears 37 times. It is the Hebrew word havel, which means a mist or a vapor. He's saying that life as I have come to discover it is nothing but a mist. It's a vapor. It's an emptiness. It's a hollowness. It's dissatisfying. It's unfulfilling. Without God, life is as meaningless, Solomon says, as a puff of breath on a cold morning. It's here one instant, then it's gone. In the language of a seminary professor, he defined this Hebrew word havel as whatever is left after a soap bubble is broken. Life without God is like chasing soap bubbles. We do that a lot of times in the front yard with my three kids, only three of them can run. And we blow the soap bubbles. And they chase those bubbles all over the yard, and they chase them, and they chase them, and they chase them. But it's interesting, when they catch them, they explode in their fingers, and they have nothing to show for it. Solomon is saying, this is what life is like. I've now spent years chasing and chasing and chasing the soap bubbles, and every time I think I've got onto something, it pops in my fingers and I've got nothing to show for it. The key word is vanity. But the key phrase, which appears 29 times in the book, is the phrase under the sun. For this is the limitations of Solomon's search. He searched for meaning and for purpose, but he limited his search to those things which were under the sun. He approached life as if God were not a part of it. He made his search ruling God out. He approached life apart from God, and as a result, he found vanity. You see, Ecclesiastes is the result of searching for meaning under the sun. Searching for meaning and purpose apart from Jesus Christ and from the Father. Solomon is not the only man who's come up with frustration and who's grasped for the salt bubble only to have it break into his hands. There's a French proverb that reads, "Life is an onion, and one cries while peeling it." Shlomo Akim, a Jewish rabbi, describes life as a blister on top of a tumor and a boil on top of that. Henry Thoreau said, "The mass of men live lives of quiet desperation." Ernest Hemingway described life, "There is no answer to man's dilemma. I live in a vacuum that is as lonely as a radio tube when the batteries are dead and there is no current to plug into." Eugene O'Neill said, "Life's only meaning is death." George Bernard Shaw said, "Life is a series of inspired follies." Peter DeVries put it, "Life is a crowded superhighway with bewildering cloverleaf exits on which a man is liable to find himself speeding back in the direction he came." And Charlie Brown, the famed philosopher, said, "I have a new philosophy. I'm only going to dread one day at a time." Perhaps you felt that way about life from time to time. That life under the sun, that the world in which we live and all that it offers tends to be nothing but bursting soap bubbles. We grasp for it. We feel like we've got it. We feel like we've finally locked on to what's going to give us fulfillment and satisfaction. And then eludes our grasp. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Thank God that's not how it has to be. That through Jesus Christ, there is hope, there is fulfillment, there is satisfaction in life. Jesus said in John chapter 10, "I have come that they may have life, and that they may have it more abundantly." In Ephesians chapter 2, he tells us that we're not limited to life under the sun, for he says that we've been raised up together and made us to sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. Our hope is in the life above the sun. In 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58, we're told that, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain." It's not vanity in the Lord. And in Colossians chapter 3, we're told that, "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, for you died and your life is hidden with Christ in God." Yes, if we limit our search for meaning and purpose to what is under the sun, we'll come up with soap bubbles. We'll come up empty and dissatisfied. But if we'll look to God, and if we'll look above the sun, if we'll see ourselves seated in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, and if we'll reach for the blessings that are ours in Christ, the Spirit of God, through the work of Jesus Christ, can bring satisfaction and healing and wholeness to our hearts. He can come and fill the emptiness inside and make our lives fulfilling and meaningful. Real meaning is not to be found under the sun, but in the sun, the S-O-N, in Jesus Christ. The message of Ecclesiastes is that life is meaningful only as it relates to God. We find meaning in life only as we see life in relationship to Jesus Christ. He continues, "What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun?" That's kind of a nice way of saying, why get up in the morning? You know, what's the use? He says, "One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides." Solomon becomes a scientist. He begins to compare the temporalness of man with the permanence of nature. He says, "One generation passes away, another generation comes and goes. Empires rise and fall. Families come and go. The redwoods in California were here long before you were here, will be here long after you're here. The rocks in the Grand Canyon will be here long after we're all dead and gone. Your trees in your front yard are going to outlive you." You see, nature is so permanent, man is so temporal and transitory. You know, what is our life? It's just a blip on the radar screen of history. Here one minute, gone the next. It's a frustrating observation for Solomon. He says, "The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens," or literally pants its way to the place where it arose. It moves across the sky like a thirsty dog, panting and creeping as it goes. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Here Solomon notes the process of evaporation, how that through the sun and the winds, the water is collected and produced, vaporized and turned into the atmosphere. And then it rains again on the ground and flows back into the sea. And the process continues on and on. They say that 97% of the water on the earth is in the seas. Only 0.001% is actually in the atmosphere at any one time. There's only enough water in the atmosphere for about 10 days of rain. And yet, it's constantly being replenished. The cycle continues. Life is cyclical, Solomon is saying. Nature works like clockwork. Nature is dependable. There are laws that govern the processes of nature. And they work with or without man. Man plays a very minor role in it all. Solomon has become the scientist, and he recognizes that we're dealing with a closed system. A system that's self-contained and works on its own, and man really has little to do with it. That's frustrating to him. He says, "All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." You see, Solomon's point to this all is that there is motion in the universe, but there is no meaning. Life seems to only be monotony. The same things going on, with or without man's involvement. Why does man matter? He seems that man is trapped in this monotony of life. That life is cyclical. That things come and go, and yet things really don't change. This is one of the things I sensed most when I spent a little time in Europe this past fall. In Europe, the buildings around you are thousands of years old. You walk down the street and there's a fountain that, you know, was dedicated in 500 A.D. Or here's a building that was built in 300 B.C. And you realize, wow, you know, we're really only one small slice of humanity. We're only living one slither of history. Here in the United States, things are all relatively so new. It's as if, you know, we haven't been around that long, and you get the impression, you get the illusion that the individual really counts, that he really stands out on the human page. But when you go to Europe, you sense that, hey, we're only one dot in the vast, infinite sea of humanity. Your life, the things that are really important to you, have been important to others before, will be important to those in the future. The things that really are important to you make up a drama that will be played out over and over and over again. It's kind of discouraging, isn't it? The same problems you face will be faced by the next generation. You solve your problems, but that doesn't mean the next generation will solve their problems. They'll be dealing with the same problems, coping with the same frustrations. Life is always changing, and yet it never really changes. The actors change, the props change, but it's the same stage, the same storyline, the same script, over and over from generation to generation. Families come and go, empires rise and fall, but nothing really changes. Solomon says, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. Isn't it amazing how the world loves that which is new? It hungers for the novel. There is something about the newness and the freshness of a thing that we crave, that we desire, that we can really break out of the monotony of life. You come up with a new invention. You write a new song and you feel so special, so important. I've come up with something new. I've come up with something different. And yet, don't you think that other people in other times have come up with new inventions that have done just as much for their time and for their society as yours will do for yours? Don't you think that other people have come up with new songs that were desired to be heard just as much as people might desire to hear yours? When you really stop and think about it, nothing is really new. It's just the same old thing repackaged over and over. Our problem is that we often mistake the novel for the original. It's been said that the ancients have stolen all our best ideas. Marcus Aurelius, the Greek philosopher, said, "They that come after us will see nothing new, and they who went before us saw nothing more than we have seen." And yet the world hungers for something new. We jump on every fad that comes along. Let's look at the fashion industry. Always coming out with a new fashion, a new style. And we rush off to the stores to buy it up so that we don't appear out of style or outdated. And yet I've discovered if you'll just hold on to your old clothes long enough, those old antiquated garments, if you'll just hold on to them long enough, you'll be back in style. Because it's all cyclical. What goes around comes around. Nothing's really new. It's just repackaged. You know, Satan loves to recycle old ideas. He loves to take old temptations and simply repackage them. He loves to spread old lies. The New Age, for example, is really nothing more than the old lie. It's the same lie he sold Satan, and it's the same lie he sold Eve in the Garden of Eden, that, oh, you can be your own God. And that's what people are trying to be today, their own God. There's really nothing new. Be careful of the cults and the false religions who come along offering you a new idea, a new religion. Hey, this is new. This is fresh. I like what Harry Ironside once said. If it's new, it's not true. And if it's true, it's not new. Be leery of that which is billed new. There's really nothing new under the sun. He says in verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. You see, the reason we sometimes mistake things for being new is that we have such poor memory. We haven't bothered to read the minutes of the last meeting. We really don't have a grasp of history. And history tells us one thing, and that's that history repeats itself. That men make the same mistakes over and over and over again. You know, there's only one person who can truly make something new, who can truly create something new, and that is the Creator Himself. In Revelation 21, verse 5, He says, "Behold, I make all things new." You know what He begins with? He begins with you. He begins with me. He begins with a new you. He comes into your heart, into the center of your life, into your spirit. And He cuts out that sinful nature, that nature that's insensitive and callous and cold to the things of God. And He replaces it with a new nature, one that loves and fears God. He places within you the desire to love and to be obedient. He begins with a new you. Paul says that we are new creations in Christ Jesus. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things have become new. If you really want something new, turn to Jesus Christ. He begins with a new you, but then He gives you a new song. Romans tells us He gives us newness of life. In Lamentations, we're told that His mercies are new every morning. We have a new hope. We're waiting for a new heaven and a new earth. Yes, if there's anyone who can do anything that's truly new, it's Jesus Christ. There's only one way to break out of life's monotony, and that's to stop looking under the sun and start looking to the sun, Jesus Christ. He says, "I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This grievous task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised." Notice He calls life a grievous task. It is God-given, but it's still grievous. Now notice that this is no frivolous exercise on Solomon's part. He is determined. He is seeking to apply the wisdom that he has to this quest for meaning and this quest for purpose. And he's about to turn to a lot of different subjects. He's about to go down different avenues in search for meaning. And he records for us the results and what he finds. He says, "I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind." I think it's significant that Solomon conducted this search. For of all the men who have ever lived, Solomon was perhaps the wisest. The wisdom of Solomon has become proverbial. We know that in Solomon's day, people came from all over the world to hear his wisdom. The Queen of Sheba came and was impressed with his wisdom. And yet, in and of himself, Solomon proved a fool. the wisest man who ever lived proved a fool when he tried to find meaning and purpose in life under the sun, apart from God. You know, there are billions of people on the world tonight who are trying to find meaning and purpose in life apart from God. Let it be known that if Solomon couldn't do it, what makes you think you can? If it eluded a wise man like Solomon, your attempt is absurd. He says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I love how the Living Bible translates or paraphrases verse 15. What is wrong cannot be righted. It is water over the dam, and there is no use thinking of what might have been. Solomon is saying, apart from God, my life became a trail of wasted years. Life became impossible to redeem. It truly ended in vanity and grasping for the wind. He says, I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Solomon says, the more I tried to know, the more frustrating it became, because the more I realized that I didn't know. T.S. Eliot once said, all our knowledge brings us nearer to our ignorance. There is an old proverb that rings true. The wise man is never happy. He knows too much. He's posed too many questions, and he's found too few answers. There was a man who went to buy his son a Christmas present. And he went to the toy shop, and he found a particular toy where the toy came unassembled. In fact, the toy was designed so that no matter how hard the child tried to put the pieces together, it was designed so that the pieces would never come together. The point of the toy was to teach the child something about life. That apart from God, none of the pieces really come together. That you're left with a lot of unanswered questions. That the lines find no convergence. There's no ending, there's no period to the questions, there's no answer, there's no solution to the problems. You end up with a lot of pieces that just don't fit together. And without God, the harder you try to put them together, the more confusing they become. He said, for in my much wisdom I found great grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. Now remember, in chapter 1, first, Solomon became a scientist. He looked to nature to find meaning and purpose, and instead he found that it was a closed system. That it operated without man, didn't really need man at all, and he struck out. He found no purpose in nature. Then he became a historian. And he traced down through history to try to find meaning and purpose in life, only to discover that nothing is really new. That history is cyclical. Same thing happens over and over again. As nature is a closed system, history became a closed book. And then at the end of the chapter, he became a philosopher. He thought through wisdom he could find the answers and the solutions, but the harder he tried, the deeper his problems became. Here, Solomon becomes a hedonist. He seeks to find meaning in pleasure. He adopts the playboy mentality. Live for the weekend. Solomon becomes the party animal. He says, maybe I can find it in mirth. Maybe I can enjoy pleasure. Maybe through the sensual things of life, I can find satisfaction. Grab for all the gusto. If it feels good, do it. The new Reebok commercial. Life is short. Play hard. The live for the weekend mentality. Sounds so familiar. And yet it's a path that men have traveled before and have failed to find meaning, satisfaction, and pleasure. He says, I said of laughter, it is madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. And yet, as he concluded in verse 1, it all was vanity. Understand that Solomon was not only wise, he was also wealthy. Not only was he the wisest man who ever lived, he was probably the wealthiest man who ever lived. Go back in 1 Kings, the first 10 chapters. Solomon had cornered the market on gold. He had it all. And as a result, if ever there was a man who could be able to throw a tantalizing party, it certainly would have been Solomon. He had the resources. Remember, too, he had 1,000 wives and concubines. He had great wealth. Wine, women, and wealth. He had it all. If ever there was a person who could find satisfaction and fulfillment in pleasure, Solomon could have found it. There was nothing that was not at his disposal. Nothing that was not available to him. He lived in such luxury. There's archaeological evidence that tells us that Solomon even sent men during the summertime up to Mount Hermon to collect snow so that he could enjoy cold drinks during the heat of the year. That was the kind of luxury that he enjoyed. If ever there was a man who could have found meaning and satisfaction through pleasure, it would have been Solomon. Solomon partied hardy. But I'll tell you one thing about Solomon. He was an honest hedonist. He was. He was not just trying to escape the emptiness of life. There are a lot of people who do that. They go out and get drunk or they go out and get stoned just to escape. Just to numb the pain of their emptiness and their heartache. There are those who try to drown out the disillusionment that life has created. But that's not Solomon's attitude at all. He is making a legitimate attempt. He is determined to apply his wisdom to this pursuit of pleasure and to try to find some kind of meaning and some kind of purpose in life through the pursuit of pleasure. And boy, did he throw a party. I would imagine that Solomon's parties probably made Las Vegas look like the sideshow at a neighborhood carnival. He was a man who tried to find satisfaction through sensuality, fulfillment through the lust of the flesh, contentment through carnality. Solomon approached life as a test, as he says in verse 1, I will test you with mirth. If it's out there, if there's meaning and purpose in this, I'll find it. I'll grasp it. His was an experiment in the erotic. And yet his experiment failed miserably. At the conclusion of it all, he said, vanity, vanity. It's all vanity. When the party was over, Solomon went home empty. And no more satisfied than when it began. You know, if ever there were a group of people who were determined to duplicate Solomon's pursuit, it would be 20th century America. We are crazed pleasure maniacs. They say that every week in America, 12 million golfers vie for tee times. Every week in America, 9 million tennis players compete across the nets. Every week in America, 4 million skiers glide down the slopes. Every year in America, 23 million hunters and fishermen comb the woods for racks and recreation. We are a pleasure-mongering people. The purpose in life is to have fun, to enjoy the weekend. And yet, does it really bring us satisfaction? Does it really bring fulfillment? It's amazing, the more you drink, the less you like it. The more you have sex, the less you like it. There's a law of diminishing returns that goes with the lust of the flesh. Where the more you get of something, the less you like it, the less you want it. That's why it's such an addicting thing, because you always have to up the ante to keep yourself going. That's why pornography is degenerating. It gets you to a place, but then it doesn't satisfy you with the same degree of stimulation, and so it has to provide a deeper form or a broader form of perversion. It doesn't satisfy. It produces a discontentment and a frustration. It destroys your life. It doesn't build it up. As Jesus said to the woman at the well, "You drink this water and you'll thirst again. You drink of anything under the sun and you'll thirst again." Right now you want that boat more than anything else in the world. Well, go ahead and get the boat. You'll thirst again. You want the condo on the lake. Go ahead and get it. You'll thirst again. It's amazing how those boats that we needed and we wanted, how they end up sitting in the driveway and we never really used them. You'll thirst again. There is a God-shaped vacuum in the soul of every man. You can try to plug lust or the wine or women or pleasure or anything you want. Try to plug it in there. It doesn't fit. It's a God-shaped void and vacuum, and only God can fill it. Only God can take care of that emptiness in our hearts. It was said of Ernest Hemingway, he was born in 1899 and was the epitome of the 20th century man. At age 25, he sipped champagne in Paris and later had well-publicized game hunts in Africa and hunted grizzly bears in America's Northwest. At the age of 61, after having it all, wine, women, song, a distinguished literary career, and Sunday afternoon bullfights in Spain, Hemingway chose to end his life, blowing his head off, leaving a note saying, "Life is one damn thing after another." That's how the world lives. That's what life is like under the sun. One frustrating, empty thing after another. It was Solomon who said in the Proverbs, "Even in laughter the heart may sorrow, and the end of mirth may be grief." When the party's over, you're just as empty as when you begin. He says, "I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house." 1 Kings 5 tells us he added about 30,000 different servants and workers. "Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me." Notice that Solomon has now turned. He's turned from enjoyment to employment. He's no longer trying to find fulfillment in the things he can consume. Now he's trying to find fulfillment in the things he can construct. He's gone from pleasure to ambition. He now is finding his fulfillment in building a business. He's gone into the empire building business. And he's trying to make his mark on life by building his empire. All these things that he's built, all these things that he's accumulated. He says, "Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity. All was emptiness, all was nothingness, and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun." All his ambition, all his business pursuits led to one conclusion. So what? Big deal. It's all vanity. So what if I become chairman of the board? So what if my portfolio is full and plenty? Prosperous. So what in the long run if I become successful in business? Henry Ward Beecher said, "Success is full of promise until men get it, and then it is last year's nest from which the birds have flown." Ambrose Bierce said, "Success is the death of endeavor and the birth of disgust." Once you've got it, it's no longer as attractive. It loses its luster. You find that it's vanity, vanity. It's all vanity. People think that by accumulating money, they can find meaning and purpose, or at least they live that way. And yet, no less an authority than the Wall Street Journal printed this comment: "Money is an article which may be used as a universal passport to everywhere except heaven and as a universal provider of everything except happiness." Money doesn't buy happiness. And Solomon says money doesn't buy meaning. He said, "I didn't find purpose in my purse. It was vanity. Vanity." I heard of a successful businessman who had really hit a roadblock in life. He had really become frustrated. He'd become discontent and dissatisfied. And he had sought his pastor for counsel. He said to the pastor, he said, "Sir," he says, "I've been climbing the ladder of success for years and years and years. I've made it to the top. But just recently I've discovered that the ladder was leaning against the wrong wall." The pursuit didn't bring him what he wanted. It didn't bring him the satisfaction and fulfillment that his heart craved. There is a cathedral in Milan, Italy. And there are three doorways going into the cathedral. The doorway to the right says, "All that pleases is but for a moment." Above the doorway to the left, it reads, "All that troubles is but for a moment." And the doorway that goes through the center reads, "Nothing is important save that which is eternal." This was the conclusion that Solomon came to. That under the sun, it was all vanity. Life became meaningful as it related to God. He said, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Now he's trying to figure out how he can make his mark on life, and yet he begins to think, what can I really accomplish that people before me have already accomplished and people after me will go ahead and accomplish? I mean, I really can't do anything unique, anything different. He says, then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceive that the same event happens to them all. And this is frustrating. You'd think that the wise man would get ahead. He says, so I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. Here I am, the wisest man in all the earth, and yet I've got frustrations, I've got problems just like the fool has. Doesn't make sense. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? Just as the fool. Now, Solomon was a man who had valued wisdom. Remember when God asked him, you know, I'll grant you one request. Solomon said, I want wisdom. And yet he discovered that wisdom apart from God is just as vain and just as empty. Knowledge, education is just as empty as his pleasure, as his work and labor. There are people who value education and they think that they're going to find fulfillment and true happiness through education. They work for years and years and years for that doctorate. And yet, what does it really bring? What good is it? A few months after you're dead, you'll be forgotten just as the high school graduate would be forgotten. Just as the elementary school dropout is forgotten. Maybe it'll gain you a few accolades at your funeral. But in the long run, what does all that education really matter? So what if you've got a string of initials after your name on your tombstone? Big deal. The wise man and the fool both die. They're both forgotten. The man who's earned a good reputation, his reputation is forgotten just as quickly as the man who had a bad reputation. How often do we remember people that achieve success and fame? How fleeting is fame? Who was our 25th president? Who won the World Series in 1952? Who was the National League Most Valuable Player in 1968? These were big awards, but who knows them now? Who founded General Motors? Who invented the ballpoint pen? Pretty significant accomplishments. And yet, who remembers them now? They're forgotten. Fame is fleeting. How quickly we're all forgotten, the wise man and the fool. Maybe you're remembered 1 year. Maybe you'll be remembered 2 years, maybe 10 years by your wife. Who's going to remember you much longer than that? It's frustrating. It's emptiness. It's vanity. Life under the sun. You know, I'm not near as concerned about being known on earth as I am about being known in heaven. As I would imagine, if you're known in heaven, that reputation will carry for all eternity. He says, therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind. You know, I work and I work and I work and I leave it for somebody else to enjoy. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? I mean, I could have worked all this my life, you know, to create this fortune, to give it to somebody who's going to take it out and throw it away in a night. Doesn't make sense. Doesn't seem fair. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I have toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor in which I had toiled under the sun. I work and work and work. I give it to somebody else to enjoy. It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right. You would think there would be a better system, is what he's saying. He says, for there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill. Yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work grievous. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. This also is vanity. Here's a man who's built his business from the ground up. Every day, he's worked 16-hour days, 7 days a week. He's worked and worked and worked. He's carved this thing out with his bare hands. He stayed up nights contemplating the next day's decisions, trying to get the edge, thinking through the decisions, trying to gain a degree of expertise in his business and in what he wants to accomplish. Long days, long nights, all his life. And then he struck with the thought, hey, I can give this to somebody who doesn't know a thing about this business. And it can all be gone in one bad decision. This was prophetic. For you remember, Solomon's son Rehoboam tore down everything his father had built up. It happened to Solomon. There are some men, of course, who try to make arrangements ahead of time. Their inheritance goes to the right people who make the right decisions with it. There are those who have pledged their inheritance to Christian organizations that are going to take the money, employ the money for good. But let me ask you, what makes you think that a Christian organization today will remain a faithful institution over time? Institutions go bad just like people. How do you know for sure what's going to happen to it after you die? You really don't. John Harvard left a fortune to the university that bears his name. John Harvard was a Bible-believing Christian who loved God and wanted to see his fortune used to propagate the Christian faith. Look at what his money and the foundation is going to today. Harvard University has become the bastion of liberalism and humanism and atheism. He'd roll over in his grave if he knew his money had gone to establish what it had established. So how do you know? He says, there is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? He admits he's the king. He's got it all. He says, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him who is good before God. And this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now you would think that he would close this section with a stern warning, prohibiting us from coming in contact with pleasure or with ambition. But that's not the attitude he takes at all. In fact, he says, it's nothing better than to eat and drink, to enjoy good in your labor, to make the most out of life, to enjoy life. It's okay to enjoy life. Life and its pleasures are a gift from God. The walk in the park, the smile on your child's face, a steak dinner, a successful sale. These are all blessings from God.
Life is good. Life is God's gift to us. And to not savor the life that God has given us is a sin. He means for us to enjoy life, to work hard, to have fun. In fact, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17, Paul says, God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. He says, God has given us richly all things to enjoy. But here's Solomon's point. Enjoy your work. Enjoy the rewards of your labor. Have fun. Enjoy life. But don't expect more out of life than life can give. Don't put too much pressure on life. Don't approach life with too high of an expectation. For the deep thirst in your soul can never be satisfied with things under the sun. Derek Kidner said, "What spoils the pleasures of life for us is our hunger to get out of them more than they can give." We try to take the orange and squeeze it and get out of it all the juice that we can get. We take hold of life and life's pleasures and life's promotions as if, wow, this is what's going to satisfy. This is what's going to really make me happy and really fulfill me. And we end up invariably disappointed because we expect out of life more than life was designed to give. God never intended you or I to find meaning and fulfillment under the sun. He meant for us to find our satisfaction in a spiritual relationship, in getting to know and experiencing the person of Jesus Christ. The only place where we can find real meaning, ultimate meaning and fulfillment, is above the sun. Reinhold Messner is a very famous mountain climber. He was one of two people who were first to make it to the top of Mount Everest without the aid of oxygen bottles. But Reinhold Messner thought that that wasn't enough, that he tried to do the same thing on his own, by himself, and he succeeded. As with every mountain climber, they're always asked the question, why did you do it? They asked Messner, why did you climb the mountain by yourself? He gave an interesting answer. He said, because at the top, all the lines converge. At the top, all the lines converge. See, life appears to be a series of absurdities. One series of folly after another. It doesn't make sense. The pieces don't fit together. It's because we don't have the right vantage point. But when we go to the top, when we get a perspective above the sun, when we get a heavenly perspective, when we adopt and begin to learn to see life through God's perspective, we see all the lines converging. All things do work to good, work together for good to those who love God and are called to His purpose. There is meaning and purpose in life. But it's found as we relate each aspect of our life to our relationship with God. All the lines converge at the top. Why don't we close here in chapter 2 and we'll pick up in chapter 3 next week.